Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing the Iran war that never was and avoiding World War III, which is generally a good thing. So I guess there's some good things happening right now. Hopefully, that means that we can focus more on domestic affairs after, after the live stream, the events that happened after the live stream from last week, where we talk about Tucker and Ted Cruz and stuff like that, really escalated over the weekend. So we're going to dive in a little bit into that. I know Anthony's got some thoughts on that. I have some thoughts that I alluded to in the last video that I did regarding how, I guess my overall take on this. And one thing that I didn't really do a whole lot of during the time was I didn't necessarily doom or panic or, I was just kind of, the meme right now is monitoring the situation. I was just monitoring the situation because that's kind of what I do regardless of, with a lot of different wars that are going on across the world. You just monitor the situation, see what's happening. And it turns out the status quo we're back to the status quo already. And Trump is hailing it as a 12-day war. An allusion to the Six-Day War, but also, he's trying to definitively call it. He's trying to call it as over. So there's a lot to break down here because this risked the entire MAGA legacy. This risked the entire Trump, presidency and definitely the MAGA legacy and movement moving forward. Like, this event had the capability to destroy MAGA as a movement in perpetuity, I think. So, I don't know if you wanted to, bite off a little bit more of that and just run with it. Like, what are your opening thoughts here?
I know I was probably saying for months that the biggest threat to Trump's presidency would be getting into a war with Iran. And it would have always been Iran because there's not like there's another war that would like America would be entangled in. It was always Iran. You had plenty of politicians going on Fox News slobbering about the need to attack Iran. And obviously last week, the big talking point that the neocons were bringing up was regime change, which would inherently require boots on the ground because you can't do regime change with a bunch of bombers unless you want to literally use nuclear ordnance. So that was the talking points of the neocons, and they didn't get that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of contradicting. Oh, I think the neocons wanted boots on the ground, first of all. I think you might be underestimating their delusion and desire for regime change in nations that they know nothing about. Case in point with Ted Cruz. So with that said, I think a regime change war was is basically the only way that Iran could really come out with a military W, I think, is to do, they get invaded and they have an insurgency that outlasts the United States. I think that would have been, that's certainly what the Russians would have most geopolitically benefited from because they can arm the Iranians it's their turn.
It benefits Russia in two ways because, again, it creates our version of a Ukraine, except far worse.
At least the Russians are going to get land and stuff. And, they're fighting for Russians. Like, yeah, they're fighting to get Russian people back on their side of the border.
Well, the flip side is that the Russians get to sell energy. The energy prices go up. They skyrocket because Iran's oil flow, the Strait of Hormuz is threatened. So that's Europe's oil supply. That's China's oil supply. So China goes right into the hands of Putin. So that's a huge benefit for Putin to have us entangled in Iran.
And
again, the way I saw it strategized was we would airdrop soldiers in, which means that they would probably be surrounded by militias in the mountains, which functionally would be a disaster.
Yeah, that does not sound like a fun time, because you think about Iran, like Tehran is more or less in the center of Iran. It's more central. It's along the Silk Road. So you would either have to do an amphibious invasion, which is not going to be a fun time, or you invade Iraq as a staging ground to then invade Iran, which seems preferable to invading Iraq amphibiously. But then you're bringing up, oh, let's just do airborne operations. That's not a good plan. That's not a good idea, especially if you're in a boondoggle to assert regime change. So much could have gone wrong. And it seems like for the time being, everything went right politically, not necessarily militarily. We'll maybe get into that momentarily. But as far as Trump's navigation of the situation without blowing up his base, because, you know, Trump has to deal with the warring factions of neocons who control a lot of the dollars and the MAGA base, which basically is driving the conversations and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the neocons functionally control Congress.
Right.
And Trump has zero cooperation with his own party, despite the fact that he has a major political mandate with his electoral victory. And right. He has the will of the American people. I mean, but he has a lot of politicians across, you know, or a lot of Republicans across the various spectrum that do not want to cooperate. You got Thomas Massie and this libertarian bent, this purity spiraling, you know, it's not enough spending cuts, libertarianism, which again, seems to only really matter when, you know, Trump needs it. And then you have the Rand Paul types that, you know, again, kind of similar to Thomas Massie. It was the Republicans that killed the judicial review clause that's in the big beautiful bill. That was the Republicans that killed that, not the Democrats.
Can you explain more of what that was?
So that was
I've only vaguely heard about this.
We mentioned it the other week. It was the clause that basically prevents the courts from holding the administration in contempt over their judicial reviews or their rulings. And that was essentially taken out of the bill from the because of obstinance in the Senate.
Really? I wish that Congress and the things that happen in Congress were more important and I could pay attention to them. But unfortunately, you know, I have the thumbnail for this video and live stream is Nothing Ever Happens. It's the Nothing Ever Happens Chud. Chud Jack or whatever it's called. And yeah, just that's my feelings on Congress. Like nothing ever happens with Congress. So I wish, like, in this big, beautiful bill might be the first time that something actually does happen, at least in a while, just because of how much is packed in there. And, you know, it actually builds the wall and accomplishes a lot of the MAGA agenda. But we're getting back into old habits with, you know, now that the bill's in the Senate, where, you know, maybe there's five good Republican senators. Like, am I, you know, completely, I mean,
you just had a,
am I standard deviations below what the actual number is?
I mean, we just had to deal with Mike Lee wanting to sell off the American parks to BlackRock and other foreign developers.
Right. And I wrote about that at Evangelical Dark Web, how the Christian nationalists are more so against selling off public land, whereas the theonomists are more in favor of selling off public land.
Yeah, I mean,
which came up in the Stephen Wolf, David Reese debate at the conference.
Yeah, libertarianism and theonomy, it certainly falls short, especially on subjects like that, where there's not really a Bible verse that can dictate it. And trying to read ancient polity into modern concepts is just not a good idea, especially on questions like eminent domain. It just doesn't, like, you can't have a society with 300 million people without eminent domain.
Yeah. And that's why it's like nothing really ever happens. You know, I'm also, you know, very, I'm very bullish on executive authority, you know, in my read of the Constitution. Like, I don't, like, because if you ask yourself, what happens if something happens and the Congress is in recess? You know, is the president supposed to not declare, is the president supposed to not deploy the military for action? The president, you know, so the idea that the president needs, you know, Congress for certain military actions, I'm not a huge believer in, because I think a declaration of war, with two exceptions in the entire history of the United States, a declaration of war is reserved for a European power. Like, you know, that's not, it's not a courtesy that's used on, say, the Barbary pirates or the Native or the Indians. Like, they don't get a congressional declaration of war because they're not on the same level as Congress wants to operate at. So the Japanese, you know, they're not European, but they were a copy of a European power. Like, they really tried to be a European power. And then the Mexicans, who also kind of tried to be a European,
they're still colonial, Spanish power.
Right, but those are like the only exceptions to, you know, a congressional declaration of war is really only for white country, white European powers. So, just historically speaking, that's, and that's not related to how often the U.S. has had military intervention or actions. So it's kind of, I just think, you know, arguing what Trump can or can't do, I just think is moot, because Congress has the power to declare war.
I mean, if you can do it, and that's about, you have, if you can do it, you have the power to do it.
Simple right. As that. I mean, the commander in chief, you know, can make war, but he can't declare it. And he can wage war and fight war, but he can't declare war.
Yeah, I mean, again, that goes back to like Thomas Massey trying to say, oh, War Powers Act, how dare you violate the Constitution with the bombing run, which is like the dumbest argument against it you could possibly make.
I thought the War Powers Act allows for like 60 days without congressional approval or response, which Obama actually did violate that, the length of that, with his intervention in Libya, which again was a regime change war by the United States, because the United States wanted to get engaged in the Arab Spring, which has had negative effects all over the Middle East. Congratulations, you just allowed Islamic enthusiasts to, yeah, I don't want to say extremists, because they're actually the Muslims that believe in Islam. So they're not really extreme, but they're the enthusiasts of Islam, take over a bunch of countries like Libya, Egypt for a time. Now they took over Syria, and yeah. So, yeah, the and then Yemen, I don't know if that was completely Arab Spring, but the thing about Yemen is, if you looked at a globe from like, I don't want, you know, the, like the 1960s-ish, if you looked at a globe from them, Yemen, I believe, was split between two countries. And that is basically where the split, or I guess when Yemen was united into Yemen, they, you know, it was those two areas that are now fighting that united into one country. So Yemen, honestly, I think the Trump administration should negotiate a partition of the country, and then there we go back to what it used to be. So, but has war on terrorism ended yet? That's a good question. Like, the global war on terror.
It's not meant to be won. It's meant to be continuous.
Yeah, I guess that's a good answer. You know, we pulled out of Afghanistan, which, again, why were we in Afghanistan? No one really knows. It really wasn't because of 9/11, because that's not why we were there past the death of Osama bin Laden. That's not why we're, and Osama bin Laden probably was not in Afghanistan.
I mean, the way I heard it said was that every election cycle that we were in Afghanistan, the reason for the war changed.
Yeah. So
we dismantled the Taliban government. We established what like democracy. Then it's like, we got to stay and do nation building. Then it's like, we got to stay and win the hearts and minds of the people. And then we're just kind of here to be here. And then we need to pull out.
Yeah. So with that said, let's go back to the Iran question, because Iran's pretty They got a very interesting country history, I should say. I mean, the name Iran is derived from Aryan because the Shahs were a mustache man respecting nation, and they were a little bit too neutral during World War II that it made the Allied powers uncomfortable, so they kind of invaded at one point in time. And then shortly after, they have British-style democracy. And I always find this ironic about nation-building and America's nation-building. Our nation-building, wherever we go, we don't even export our own style of government. We export British parliamentary democracy, which is like the government we revolted against, was the British Parliament. That's what America fought a war of independence against, was British Parliament. And yet every time we actually do nation building, we're not giving them a bicameral Congress. We're giving them British democracy, which is perhaps the worst system of government that's ever been invented. I always find that interesting. We call it regime change. We call it nation building, but it's like we're building them with the worst parts.
It doesn't even have like the positive components that, like a robust aristocracy. Yeah, like a robust aristocracy, because, you know, that's what the parliament used to be.
Yeah. So like we're giving them the worst system of government in total. But anyway, the British, there was a prime minister in Iran who got a little, who was becoming more or less a dictator. He had like their parliament suspended and stuff like that for a time. So he was, you know, giving himself some dictatorial powers. And then the United States had a coup in operation 1953, which barely worked. Like people say, oh, America did regime change in Iran in the 1950s. Yes and no. Like how much of that was the United States put things in the pieces versus the United States capitalize on existing tensions and political winds. According to, like, you know, there's a pretty lengthy article, and there's a lot of stuff on this. If you were to research the situation, like the CIA really thinks they got lucky with this one. Like their mission succeeded in doing regime change in Iran, but it really was not, it wasn't like, oh, they put these flyers out and it automatically stirred the people to excitement. It was more like the crowds and mobs were already, forming, and they just kind of capitalized on the existing tension that was there. Like they tried to foment things and it didn't work. And then all of a sudden something changed and then, you know, the Shah was popular again. And then, you know, people blame America for the Shah not being, for being brutal. I don't really think that was the issue. I just think he was not Islamic enough, and that was the real issue. And thus, this guy who was giving away cassette tapes, he was preaching on cassette tapes and distributing them all throughout Iran. That's, again, how old this technology is. That guy kind of foments an Islamic revolution using Islamic students in 1979. And that is the regime we have in Iran today.
Yeah, I mean, one thing about the regime is that it's not exactly as strong or competent as it wants to, like, pretend that it is. Like, yeah, they kind of had, like, a nuclear program, but they're not exactly known for their competence. There isn't a lot of belief in the regime, probably within Iran. Like, the Iranian people would probably tell you that, the government isn't exactly competent, but it's better than no government at all, which is what a U.S. invasion would create. But the other thing is, if they're on the track to probably implode, and then by attacking them, we actually are helping to rally support for that government. So there's a couple. So we're actually making the problem worse to some extent.
It's very interesting because a lot of countries have made calculations that if we fight a war, we will be united and stronger for it. And you're making the calculation that it will actually happen this time because a war has been impressed upon a population. Obviously,
they're not going to go from being death to America to we love Donald Trump and thank you, America, for bringing democracy to Tehran. That's not going to happen.
They already have a parliament, by the way.
like they would probably just go from death to America with the mullahs and the Ayatollah to death to America with a secular nationalist figure, which would again just be another that's Saddam Hussein's form of dictatorship. So another nation in the Middle East did not want to tolerate. So you're just going to repeat the cycle where, oh, this new regime isn't good enough. We got to replace them next.
Yeah. So there's a lot of history around a country trying to use a war to unite its population. Russia's entry into World War I was an attempt to project strength and unify the nation. A lot of people like to simp for Tsar Alexander. I forget what his number was, but a lot of people like to simp for him, but he was not a very good king. He was not a good czar. So that's just something to consider. Austria-Hungary, they get a bad rap, but the one guy who wanted to keep peace was the guy who was assassinated, Archduke Ferdinand. So he was the one who was assassinated, which left a lot of people who said, yeah, we have to go to war now over the Serbian question, because Austria-Hungary was in a very precarious situation in the early 1900s, because they were getting weaker while every nation around them was getting stronger, specifically the Russians. So they're like, yeah, if we don't take care of this issue now, we're going to lose the opportunity to ever take care of it. And so there's a lot of nations that make these types of calculations. And of course, the calculation that the British make is that if we keep the war going on long enough, we can get more land powers to unite against the continental threat to us. Yeah, that's Napoleon and Germany in World War II. Like, that was the British just reran the same playbook. We're getting a coalition of nations against the power that we don't like.
Yeah, they wanted to prevent essentially a continental power from eclipsing them.
And we're going to send troops eventually. So that's kind of like the British approach to foreign policy. But, these nations have ambitions and stuff like that. And Iran, yeah, you are right that, an American invasion, boots on the ground in Iran, is not going to go over well. I don't think this is a Greco invasion of Persia, which went over pretty well, all things considered. Except, until Alexander the Great marched into Bactria in modern-day Afghanistan, that's when he had the most trouble militarily. But, overall, the bureaucracy turned over to him, but he was also he embraced their culture because their culture recognized him as a god. So there's a little bit like that. I don't think they're going to recognize American intervention as, a god king coming to restore order.
No, because we would be dropping a bunch of bombs on them.
And we would be telling them that secular democracy is great. So it's not going to go over well. So with that said, I think Iran has more time on their side to fight a war. Do they have the population, the demographics, maybe they don't have the missile capability. But overall, I think the longer this goes on, probably an insurgent war would be in their benefit. They would win They would look good winning that.
It's mixed. It would not be in the benefit of the current government, but it would be in the benefit of the Persian people as a people. Because however they come out of such a scenario, they would come out stronger and more united and probably more militant and more anti-American and probably with even a more competent government.
So I got to give...
On the flip side, America's resolve for war would probably only last a couple of years at most. The election cycles would absolutely decimate any party trying to fight a war because it would be for a certain country and in their interest. So as that interest dies in the American political scene, so too would support for a war quickly die.
Right. This is a pretty interesting question. We're not just going to discuss the greater Israel project coming to fruition before our eyes. So this is a reference to a dispensationalist interpretation of the boundaries. I want to say in Genesis 15, I don't want to pull a Ted Cruz here and not know the passage. Genesis 15 or 16, where Israel is defined by certain borders, and they interpret the Euphrates River to be all of the bank of the Euphrates River, and they interpret the river of Egypt to be the Nile River, which is, would be odd to not specify the Nile. So because of that, the greater Israel is defined as from the Euphrates River all the way down, and then you draw a parallel, the latitude going all the way to the equivalent spot on the Nile River, which is the longest river in the world. So how do you draw this part of the Nile and no further? I guess we're using latitude because
it kind of looks more like a triangle in the map.
Yeah. And then
or trapezoid. Yeah.
So that is how they define the borders of Israel in a lot of dispensationalist camps.
Zionism.
And Zionist as well, but Zionism predated dispensationalism. Just saying.
I don't necessarily think Israel would go full bore for that. I mean, they simply just don't have the population that's capable. But obviously, they would have a sphere of influence that would essentially encompass their neighboring countries. And that's where, and again, that's why they would actually benefit from an American invasion of Iran, is because that would just basically decimate all the other players. And then, you know, since they're all weakened, they would essentially have hegemony in the Middle East.
Right. So let's talk about Israel. And this is something that as a nation, they should be doing, is trying to become a regional power. That is what a nation's duty is to be. That is what the government should be doing. Hey, we're going to be a regional power here. We're going to do what is in the interest of doing that. Now, much of their way of doing that is terrible for the church. It is very short-sighted, like let's bomb the Assad regime so they can't fight a terrorist insurgency. And therefore, when the terrorists take over, I'm sure it'll be fine. Like, that's the short-sightedness of the Israeli government. And I'm sure I can give more examples. You know, they were the biggest benefactors of Iraq falling because Iraq, you know, posed some sort of regional rival to them. And Iran, they were the big bad in that region. They posed the most threat. They had the most vitriol. Ironically, Iran used to be an ally of Israel, you know, way back in the, you know, during the days of the Shah, they used to be sort of allies. So there's a lot going on. You know, Israel, it is, you know, this is sport. You know, nations are like sports teams, you know. You don't want the other team to do better than your team, but you recognize that they're trying to play the game. They're trying to play the game of geopolitics and becoming a regional power.
I wouldn't even say that's sports teams, because that's too much economics in comparison. It's more like gangsters, you want your turf, your territory.
Yeah, but that applies in sports too, where they each have their markets and you want to expand your influence in this market and that market. So, you know, of the country. So you want to build a fan base. So they're doing in some ways what a nation should be doing, but they're very short-sighted about it, and they're not using any sort of tact diplomacy and largely they're relying on the United States to do their dirty work for them. And that's where we get into the latest Israel-Iran war, where Israel starts a war that they know they can't definitively finish.
No, they start a war and then want us to do the cleanup work, which is what Netanyahu wanted this entire time.
And this, you know, of fake wars and rumors of fake wars is about how this war ended up being a fake war. And the Israel-Iran belligerency was real. I want to be clear. When I'm calling it a fake war, it was real for Israel and Iran against each other. I think that was real. Where it becomes fake is when America finally gets involved to step in and fight the 300-pound dude. Maybe not 300. I don't think they're bigger than America, so in this analogy. But they're fighting the dude that the drunk girlfriend picked a fight with at the bar. And they don't really want to fight. They don't want to get into a long fight. So they just kind of like, it's a stage fight. And
it's
that's
pro
really
wrestling. It's literally pro wrestling.
And that's what this was. This was a pro wrestling
It has to be stage. It has to be said that Donald Trump is president in his history with like the WWE and his love of professional like mixed combat sports. It is so, you know, fitting that he is the president that's overseeing basically a theater war.
And that's what this is. And there is historic precedent for this. Let's do a World War II analogy because everyone loves World War II analogies. They're never overplayed. But in this case, there is precedent because after the Germans invaded Poland and the Soviets invaded Poland and, you know, the Germans and the French declared war to restore Poland only on the Germans, nothing happened for like 9 months and it's called the Phony War. So that, you know, that was, if you look on like a map of like World War II, it's like, man, nothing really happened. Not a whole lot happened in 1940 until it happened. But yeah. Yeah, after September 1939, like 9 or 10 months later, nothing really happened. They did a couple bombings and stuff like that. They declared war to save face with no plan on ending it. And that, you know, that was a British foreign policy. You know, just get enough continental powers to join your coalition against the your rival. That's the British strategy. So with that said, when America got involved, you know, there's some debate about, I don't know what the reporting is on whether Trump told the Iranians he was going to do it. I think he told them that he was going to do it, but not when he would do it. So he mobilized a lot of planes. And then, you know, the planes that were actually used for the operation were not the ones that were publicly being mobilized because most of those came from the East, the ones that were used. So we're talking about sending stealth bombers to Guam and stuff like that. They're moving into the Middle East direction, but from the West. And that's more of a feint. That's a ruse. But instead, they take off from like somewhere in Missouri and then they're there. So,
yeah, I mean, the way that would work, I mean, obviously the B-2 is not exactly the fastest. They're probably using KC-130s to refuel midair, which is, you know, a pretty cool process if you think about it. You know,
very expensive.
An aerial gas station.
Yeah.
So you can, you know, continuously fly. The B-2, especially in its latest gen, is nuclear capable. So you actually can use nuclear ordnances on the B-2 in its current or latest gen.
Okay, you're more familiar with the planes than I am. But the Bunker Buster bomb, it is debated on whether it has the ability to penetrate as deep as the Iranian nuclear sites, alleged nuclear sites.
Yeah, I think its depth is rated for like 500 feet or something, but that would be in sand, not exactly in rock.
Yeah, not exactly in granite. And there were three sites that were struck, and I believe I have not seen any pictures of the other two sites. We've seen Ferdow. Sounds a little too French, but Farsi is actually more closer to a European language than you would think. But anyway, we don't really have pictures of the other two sites that I'm aware of. And it's very hard to tell because these bombs, the way they work is they create an explosion underground. So you wouldn't get a crater like you're used to seeing. We're not supposed to expect a crater, but we are supposed to. So we don't know how to measure the success. And it seems like casualties were very light, which means that the Iranians evacuated a lot of their personnel.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe a lot of their equipment was stuff was evacuated from already.
Said, I want to say on the night of, that he gave them advance warning when the bombs were in the air. And that probably meant that they had enough time to get out, probably more, and, you know, take with them whatever uranium you could store in a suitcase. I mean, and again, who knows how much preparations they were making prior to the contact with the Trump administration. But yeah, if they were making preparations prior, they could have gotten some things out. But obviously they had some time to evacuate some of their stuff and take whatever they could with them.
Yeah, so
there's the fact that he gave them advance warning is kind of a sign that Trump was not interested in a prolonged war. He was not interested in escalation, which then, you know, if you look at the Iranian counterattack, the Iranians were not interested in actually striking the Americans. They were in our greatest ally, but they were actually interested in just making a face saving maneuver.
Yeah. So the Iranian response, like you said, is face saving maneuver. And I was like thinking, it's like, wow, is our foreign, I'm not sure how real this all is. It's like, oh, we struck the Iranian nuclear sites. So what's our foreign policy plan here? Is it based on betting on the Iranian regime not having any testicles? Like, is that really our strategy here? And it's like, well, it's very dubious as to whether we actually destroyed their nuclear capabilities if the Iranians were really pursuing nuclear ambitions, which shame on them if they're not, because they're derelict in their duty to their people if they're not doing that.
I mean, it's, you know, heard on Aaron today where it's just like your sovereignty is determined by whether or not you have the bomb.
Yeah.
And obviously they were, that's why they were enriching the uranium at 60%. So that does seem to be indicative of weapons grade uranium. But, you know, it was Tulsi Gabbard that's saying that they didn't have capabilities for the bomb. But at the same time, they have every incentive to pursue it, given the hostilities of Israel to their east and the ever looming threat of a war with America, with you know, senators going on TV slobbering for blood. I mean, so it is kind of like, okay, what is it? Iran wants the bomb because they want the bomb, or is it they want the bomb because they fear a regime change war?
Yeah,
and so, it seems like if there's a feedback loop.
Right. And again, that is how nations play the game. Like, you either have to get under someone, you either have to slurp a nuclear power, which most European countries have done. And it's ironic because the British and French, they were nuclear powers on their own shortly after World War II. But The British decided after the Suez Canal crisis, where they allied with and coordinated with the Israeli military to attack Egypt. Stupid idea to ally with Israel for that, by the way. They decided, hey, we can't jeopardize the American relationship. They call it a strategic relationship or whatever. So they can't jeopardize that relationship. And the French kind of invested more into European affairs. But these nations that were nuclear still didn't establish their own sovereignty, but then you have the Russians, obviously, you know, they're imposing their sovereignty. The North Koreans, they apparently just announced they're opening a beach resort.
North Korea is funny because they always talk about, you know, wiping off American cities. So for all their talk with nuclear weapons, they're not actually intent on using them.
Yeah, honestly, maybe they're playing the long game over there. And to some degree, I think North Korea, I think, currently is on a trajectory to win the Peninsular War over there. Because South Korea is just completely imploding. And they just got taken over by a liberal regime. And you know what that liberal regime did? They stacked the courts it's all completely constitutional. They took power, they finally got power, and they shut the door so that the more right-wing South Korean parties can never get power again. So it's they played for keeps. So I think liberalism will destroy the Koreans faster than the totalitarian communism. It's a race to the bottom on that peninsula, but I think the North side will win at this point.
Or otherwise just be subverted, but.
Right. And with that said, how about we do a live read from our sponsor? I really like the sponsor, and I think you should try them out too if that's for you, and then we'll come back and talk more about this. Hey friends, Ray Fava here from Evangelical Dark Web. It is my belief that right now we need more Christian patrons. Let me ask you something. Do you have a vision for your family, your business, your community? Do you dream of building something lasting, something that glorifies God and blesses generations to come? Are you ready to become a new Christian elite? Then you need to talk to my friends at First Liberty Building and Loan. For over 30 years, First Liberty has said yes when big banks say no. They've been the bridge between visionary entrepreneurs and the capital they need to build, buy, and grow. They don't just talk about community. They are the community, grounded in Noonan, Georgia, and serving business owners across the country. Their team is deeply involved in church leadership, local government, and civic life. And they're not afraid to say it. They honor God in all they do. And that's not just marketing. It's the foundation of their business. If you're a Christian entrepreneur who wants to build multi-generational wealth, make a cultural impact, and leave a legacy, First Liberty wants to help you do it. So grab the aux code, light the torches. It's time to build your kingdom for God's glory and your children's future. Visit FirstLibertyGA.com to learn more and apply today. That's FirstLibertyGA.com. So let's, now that we're back, let's talk more about the Trump calculation here. So, because one thing that can't be ignored is that there is now a ceasefire. We've had the shadow boxing, or we've had the phony war, and now America might be in a precarious situation, even more so than what we were at during the start, because America could have just said we're not getting involved at all, and I would appreciate America not providing any offensive or defensive capabilities for Israel, because we shouldn't be subsidizing their defense for a war that they start. But we already did that. Then we did this, this phony war exercise. But now we're kind of on the hook. And that's what I guess is the biggest worry moving forward, is we're on the hook for maintaining this peace. And Israel is not known for, or let's just do a positive statement. They are known for violating ceasefire agreements.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to their credibility, it is, very predictable in that regard. Now, again, I would actually push back and say I think Trump wanted to take the off-ramp, and I think this is the off-ramp, that he's actually in a very good spot because the neoconservatives have completely blown their capital because they got the bombing. They can't get the boots on the ground war. The momentum for that has completely died. You know, a lot of the boomers that were slobbering over the idea of like bombing Iran and preventing a nuclear capable Iran, well, Trump is claiming to have stopped their capabilities. He's taken the wind out of their sails. So he's actually diminished and defeated any pretext for an American invasion of Iran and allowed all justification to pull back from Iran and to basically refocus his administration on domestic efforts. Now, whether Israel and Iran go back to fighting remains to be seen, but I think America is actually in a very good spot.
Yeah, I mean, one way we could ensure that the ceasefire is enforced is to actually enforce it, but I don't think the ceasefire was actually made. And I don't really want that to happen.
I don't actually think the ceasefire is an actual ceasefire. It's just an off-ramp. It's just a stunt. It's part of the political, pro wrestling. It's Trump using the ceasefire to basically say that America is done.
Right. It's not just that America's done. It's that Israel should be done too. I mean, Trump dropped an F-bomb regarding Israel trying to attack Iran right before the ceasefire is meant to go into effect.
And that made my morning.
I mean, yeah, Trump's got Israeli fatigue too. That too. But Trump's tired of this as well. So that's very impressive for a boomer. I just want to say that. Like, Trump is a boomer. He has a lot of the flaws of that generation. But here's some things he does really well for, that is a model for his generation. One, he knows how to pass a baton. We saw that with J.D. Vance. Yeah, he skipped Gen X, though. Sorry, Gen X. He chose a millennial to be vice president. And is basically, that's naming a successor there. So that's one thing that Trump knows how to do better. Trump is also doing.
And he does that with his children, for the record.
Yeah, Trump is also doing a little bit more noticing.
Well, I mean, he's met Netanyahu.
He's actually met him. He's not like the congressman that when he met him, he didn't wash his hand until he touched all his children after shaking his hand.
I don't know. That his browser history is probably pretty whack.
And it was probably very whack after he shook hands with Netanyahu, because he had to, you know, his children weren't the only thing that he needed to touch after shaking hands with Netanyahu. Is my read on that situation, because that is creepy and worship it. Yeah, like that's like a level of reverence. Like when Jesus was walking on the earth, people wanted to touch his clothes to get healed, and it worked, by the way. But people wanted to touch his clothes, and you know, just touch and touch. You're treating Netanyahu that way. No, that there's a level of perversion.
Gotta say no homo.
With your he didn't say no homo. So there's a level of perversion involved that, you know, no reason why it wouldn't be sexual. But with that said, Trump taking the off ramp, and now he's able to solidify the coalition. But it was a real war for Israel and Iran.
Yes.
And he came in, made it a fake war, and then ended the real war using a fake war. That's kind of my read on what just happened. Now, hopefully that maintains, like, for, because that makes Netanyahu look, you know, that probably makes him feel very angry and indignant that Trump just came in there and did that. Iran, they don't come across looking very strong right now. And maybe the neocons do get some sort of popular uprising. But again, if I'm part of the Iranian people, you should be revolting in the streets, because they don't have a nuclear weapon to defend them and their Persian honor against foreign intervention like this. So that would be if I were Persian, that would be my cause for regime change, is that they have lost the mandate of heaven by their ineptitude. But
I mean, that was the slow decline. That's the slow decline of the Iranian government. Just exemplified, though.
Right.
But I mean, again, Iran's probably got a ticking time bomb, because who knows what the future is if the Ayatollah dies, because he's 86 years old, so he could die any day now. And that needs to be on the horizon. And that could be a huge impetus for change in their government if their supreme leader is dead.
Or he just stays alive because he's just getting, you know, it's a dry climate, like jerky and stuff. But I don't know. Like, I don't know whether climate keeps you warm, dry, warm climate keeps you alive more than cold climate just freezes you. But yeah. It's an interesting situation of, like, what would the next regime look like? Like, people have that speculation about Russia. It's like, what are they going to look like after Putin? Because, again, he's kind of up there. And there's, like, a whole list of nations that have leaders that are up there in years. And it's like, the next 20 years, we could see a lot of change in the world based on how old the current crop of leaders is.
I mean,
and
Putin...
Trump's not different in that regard, but we just have a, you know, we already know he's not going to be here in 4 years. We're going to have a new president.
No, I mean, Putin, he has to keep back his hardliners, because he gets it from both sides. He might be more of a, I won't say centrist, but, you know, he's got hawks on his right, so to speak.
Putin is the most pro-West you're going to get in a Russian leader, probably in our lifetime. Like, he's as pro-West as it's going to get.
Yeah, you got plenty of people in his flanks that are saying that he's too soft.
Oh, yeah. And he's in his own must-win scenario with the Ukraine war, and I would say he's probably already won that war. So one thing that I wanted to show was this cartoon from Freedom Tunes. We're gonna do like the first minute of it.
I'm going to smack you.
So we're going to do the first minute of this, because I think this is actually very good right-wing propaganda to have Trump acting like the adult in the room against the children in the back seat. So I actually think this is excellent right-wing propaganda, and is actually kind of the messaging of how Trump should be framing himself and how we should be framing Trump in the Middle Eastern conflict.
I swear, if you two don't stop, I'm going to turn the car around.
Donald, don't get involved.
Ayatollah, I'm going to smack you. He started it.
No, he started it.
Ayatollah, that's it. In 30 seconds, I'm going to slap you. I'm warning you so you can move your head mostly out of the way.
Don't do it, Donald. Just let them fight it out back there.
15.
Donald, my king, do not.
3, 2, 1, smack. In 30 seconds, I am throwing my juice box at you. No, you are not. I am warning you so you can avoid any damage. 15 seconds. That's it. Both of you sit on your heads. You have 15 seconds to get your heads under your butts.
What are they doing?
Getting their last slaps in before the ceasefire. Good. No more seatbelts! No more seatbelts for you! No
more! Hey, we were back here hoping we could get those mass deportations now. This crap is really distracting him.
What? It's exactly what I voted for.
So that's the cartoon I wanted to show. Your thoughts on the commentary of it?
It actually captures it quite well because there were rumors circulating that Vance was against the attack. But obviously Vance came out during the press conference or the brief address that Trump gave at the White House with Rubio and Hegseth. So you had, you know, two veterans, all civilian leaders. He did not come out with brass. So the image of the civilian leadership in the administration and probably the most reliable leaders in the administration, if we're going to rank them, being the faces that came out for the, I guess, the brief presser or maybe brief address on the bomb, because he only spoke for 4 minutes. So they captured Vance's perspective quite well. They, you know, the American people, you know, are vying, you know, saying, can we get back to mass deportations? Very well done. And yeah, of course, the trunk is full like a Mexican clown car.
Now, Freedom Tunes is getting some crap for stealing that bit, that part of the bit, I think. But I just think it's parallel thinking.
I mean, it's a,
just
I mean,
you're on the side of, hey, people come up with the same jokes all the time.
Stone Tossed Comics did that like a while ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, at least it's legal immigration was, you know, their thing.
It makes you wonder, though, because obviously there's a lot of that sentiment in the United States. You know, can we get back to our own affairs? It makes you wonder how much the Israeli government, you know, just to put on the conspiracy hat, did they, like, are they trying to sabotage America's, the saving of America? Are they trying to sabotage that by distracting us with their foreign wars?
I mean, certainly
third world conflicts.
Also, the neocons want that more than Israel. I mean, Israel wants what they want, but the neocons would, you know, would rather prioritize them over mass deportations because they want that cheap immigrant labor. They want that libertarian economics. And again, their worldview, and again, their, you know, also their thoughts on civil rights, race relations, all that stuff, don't give them a lot of arguments or even a, not to use the word worldview, but they don't really have a belief system that accounts for the fact that these people don't belong here because they fundamentally do not belong here.
Yeah. But, and you're right, the neocons are as much a driving force in much of this. And the neocons, they don't have the stomach for mass deportations, it seems, but they definitely that, but they have the stomach for regime change, boots on the ground, forever wars. And can somebody make that make sense?
Interest, corporate interest.
Oh, because they got stock in Raytheon or something.
I mean, you know, a lot of these defense contractors, they're in Texas. Ted Cruz is from Texas.
So Ted Cruz, like, didn't his daughter come out as like a lesbian on TikTok in like 2022?
Something. His daughter's whack. His wife is like bushy neocon.
And I just got to think, like, is that why Ted Cruz is compromised on this? Is that why he's gay affirming now?
Because, I mean, yeah, the family is a driving force, probably.
And reason. I guess the way that he compensates for, you know, going against the authority of scriptures to lean into, you know, Zionism and dispensationalism, and his John Hagee theology, like, is that the way he's going to, you know, compensate for the fact that, you know, your daughter was being written about by gay websites for coming out?
I don't even know. Like, I would question how devout he even is if you can't even cite Genesis 12.
Yeah. It's just something I wonder, because a lot of these guys, you know, Mike Huckabee, I just think that guy has a, yeah, I don't know how to explain him other than like boomer con to the max, but
now he's the
a lot of these guys say
ambassador that who represents the country he's going to, not the country who sent him.
Yeah. Yeah. Cruz is a pastor's kid, and that's the more embarrassing part. So, I don't know how much more I want to say on this, but it seems like, the fake war, that was, nothing ever happens. And that is the ongoing meme. I don't know if anyone else is like an enthusiast for the nothing ever happens meme. I certainly love the nothing ever happens over something, over it's happening or something's going to happen. Like the debate, you know, every time there's a major event imminent, like nothing's going to happen. Or
I mean, yeah,
everyone takes a side.
If we were, you know, buying stock, I was totally buying the nothing ever happened stock going into like that Sunday into Monday morning, especially when you see the clip of Trump dropping the F-bomb. It's just like, yeah, nothing ever happens. Just like buy it.
I mean, nothing ever happens. Just one big. And that's like their biggest win of the year. It's not been a year of nothing ever happens.
It did plummet with the bombing on Saturday night.
Yeah.
So there, but it was an overcorrection.
Right. So I'll do a last call for questions because we don't have to do too long on this. But in the meantime, if you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the Channel Flip podcast if you are new. We have a Patreon-like system at Evangelical Dark Web, and you can get access to bonus content. And we have a newsletter as well, completely free, gives you Christian news in your inbox each and every day. A lot of good stuff coming up. You got an article on the ARP statement.
ARP, yes. That's in the works.
And, you know, we're going to be covering some PCA stuff there. I'd like to do more videos on the PCA, but they don't do well. Like, so I just got to be real about that. I'm going to write about Brett Cooper joining Fox News. And I don't know if you have any preliminary thoughts on that.
I mean, I'm not surprised that Fox News would want her. Obviously, she's an attractive woman, so that's in Fox News' wheelhouse, especially if she were blonde. But they are certainly branching out to that younger audience to have relevance. And they're probably going to overpay, but why not? Because they need it for their brand.
Yeah, I guess my question is, when she is on Fox News in some sort of exclusive deal, does that mean she's exclusively writing columns for them, or exclusively she shows up on their network and doesn't go on anyone else's, and she can't do her own podcast or anything like that?
Fox,
it's a contributor. It's a contributor deal. It's not you're going to be a TV host, or it's an exclusive contributor deal is my understanding of it. But that doesn't prevent her from, say, running a YouTube channel or...
I mean, they might also have signed her YouTube channel to the advertiser revenue. But I don't know if that's included or not. Because Fox News, I guess they bought like a live... Like the company that gives the sponsorships for podcasters, Fox News bought a company that does that.
So,
you know, Jeremy Boring was trying to pump and dump Daily Wire, and that was the transaction Fox News made. They didn't make a bid for Daily Wire.
Yeah, so actually, let me give a little bit more of a take on this, because it is related, because Brett Cooper going to Fox News is related to the Israel-Iran war by virtue of this is like the BoomerCon propaganda network, and they're trying to they are trying to capture a younger audience. And I don't think this is ever going to work because the medium is not working. It's the medium that's the issue, not necessarily the content on the channel. I mean, the content on the channel is a major issue, don't get me wrong, but they're a cable news network. You're already done. We don't buy cords. We move out of our parents' houses and we don't buy cable. We get the Netflix. We get the Prime. We get the HBO Max, which they've rebranded themselves back to HBO Max recently. And I don't know, maybe there's something else, but Fox News requires cable and that's not happening. They're never going to capture the younger audience because they do not operate in their medium. So it's never going to work, regardless of how many Brett Coopers.
I mean, it might be good for their YouTube and digital outreach.
Yes.
If they want to have better online content, maybe they want to actually get more into TikTok or something. But how well it does in the long run, who knows? I think it's more of a strategy play than a profit play.
Yeah. All right. We got some questions. Let's see. Will you cover Koofy conference in DC? So this is the Christians United for Israel is what Koofy stands for. It's John Hagee's organization. You put it on my radar to at least attempt to cover. So I will try to look into what is happening in the Koofy, because it could very well be interesting, because they might go full, prophecy meltdown mode. So for that reason, it could be interesting.
I mean, you got Mark Levin, Hagee, both speaking, Miriam Adelson. Serious? Yes. Who, let's just say Mark Levin is a total piece of crap who wants Americans to die for Israel
and Ukraine.
That too. Yeah.
And probably also, lockdowns. Like,
and he was bashing
pro lockdown as well.
And he was bashing Trump for the ceasefire.
Yeah.
So he is not our friend. He's not a friend of getting the American agenda done. He wants what's best for his country.
Yes.
Or as some people would say, dual loyalty would be an improvement.
Yes. Jimmy Starfish. As do you believe Trump agreed to bomb Iran quid pro quo to get some Senate votes for the BBB?
I think BBB. That is a realistic calculation that he had to make, is that you would have enough neocons in the Senate that would stonewall the bill if the Iran news cycle kept on going.
But I do got to say, Trump's political maneuvering here was that impressive that I don't think someone was leveraging him.
I mean,
so he's not acting because if someone's doing that, I don't know. If there's a senator that's trying to be a holdout, so for Iran bombing, they don't have much more leverage than just that.
I mean, I think it's not necessarily he made a deal, but so much he had to prevent himself from needing to make a deal. This was preemptive action. Because again, the longer the news cycle dragged on the whole Israel-Iran thing, the bigger and especially since they were drumming up 2003 levels of nuclear proliferation concerns, that would have kept Trump anchored to this story to where he could not focus on the big, beautiful bill. So there is a attention span bandwidth that would have been preoccupied by this issue until it was resolved. And so Trump essentially is taking, literally preemptive action, not necessarily against the Iranians, but against the Senate.
Yeah, that's a very good question, though. So good job on that. I don't see any more questions coming in. So let's kind of call it. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Had a lot of fun. Hopefully I have some fun coming up. I think in June and July and August, I'm going to try and book more guests because it seems like it's more of a slower time of year. July, I believe, is the slowest time of year for Christian news. I've been doing enough Christian news cycles that I kind of know what the slow months are. So maybe I'm going to use that time to book some guests and stuff. So that's kind of my plan. Other than that, have a blessed day. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.